the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This keeps a sin flood of statism out of your brain. Can you feel it, Bill Buford? Is it working? Can you feel it?
Philosophically terraforming the planet, one disobedient surf at a time on the Fiends.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. And I'm Mr. Michael Dean, Freedom Fiend. We're talking to Freedom Fiend Bill Buford from ZeroGov.com. Are you safe? Have you been contacted by the government, sir?
I am contacted by the government on a daily basis, as are you.
And
every time you're on the net, on the phone, anything, the government is contacting you in a very strange fashion, but they're contacting you.
Yep. And you know, we wanted to run through really quick here all the stations. We wanted to do a shout out to back and forth between Bill and I. Kinks, KINX 102.7 FM, Great Falls, Montana, 93,300 watts of tyranny busting power. Who you got next there?
KYDT, Sundance, Wyoming, 25,000 watts.
Yeah, Wywoo, WYOO 101.1 FM, Panama City, Florida, 12,000 watts.
WVFT, Tallahassee, Florida, 8,700 watts.
They get tinier. Hey, 1,000 watts covers a lot. You know, there was a pirate radio station in Charlottesville, Virginia, when I lived there. It was run by some people from the engineering school. And they had a 1-watt transmitter with the antenna pretty high up on like a 4- or 5-story building in a place that didn't have a lot of buildings higher than that. It covered the whole town well. Amarillo, Texas, KIXZ.
KENN, Farmington, New Mexico, 5,000 watts.
KNOX, 1310 AM, Grand Forks, North Dakota, 5,000 watts.
KBFS, Rapid City, South Dakota, 1,000 watts.
KVOC, Casper, Wyoming, 1,000 watts.
KDGO, Durango, Colorado, 1,000 watts.
WLSC, 1240 AM, Loras, South Carolina.
WNZS, Bangor, Maine.
Bangor? I don't even know her. Okay, KLID, 1340 AM, Poplar Bluff, Missouri.
WKRO, Cairo, Illinois.
It's Cairo, interestingly enough. They pronounce it. I had to call their Chamber of Commerce to find that out. I couldn't find it on the internet. There was a lot of discrepancy on that. Okay, KSZL, Barstow, California.
KVLI, Lake Isabella, California.
I love saying this town's name. KRSY, Alamogordo, New Mexico.
WSLA, New Orleans, Louisiana.
And Slidell, Louisiana. KZNU, St. George, Utah.
K226BQ, St. George, Utah.
KENT, 1400 AM, St. George, Utah.
K253BU, 98.5 FM, St. George, Utah.
WPBQ, Jackson, Mississippi.
WRIK, Paducah, Kentucky, and Brookport, Illinois.
KNOX, Grand Forks, North Dakota.
WQXL, Columbia, South Carolina.
WAMM, Woodstock, Virginia.
WSRQ, Sarasota, Florida.
WQXL, Columbia, South Carolina. And that's a rebroadcaster of another station in this. Some of them have several sticks, as they call it, in one area. Yeah, we go from 93,300 watts to 0.1 watt. If anyone's out there doing the math...
KENN, Farmington, New Mexico. W255CC, Sarasota, Florida. W295BH, Sarasota, Florida. And last but certainly not least, except in wattage, WSVG, Mount Jackson, Virginia, 40 watts.
40 watts, yep. Yeah, most of them are 1,000 watts, but there's a bunch on either side of that. And then there's Part 15 stations, which are the 10th of a watt. You don't need a license to run at stations, but you can still reach about a mile if you do it right. KLSR, Lakeshore Community Radio in Rowlett, Texas.
Talk Radio, 1620 AM, KTFL in Gilbert, Arizona.
And Radio Carabao?
Carabao.
Carabao. In
the Philippines.
In Manila,
See,
Philippines.
Look at that. You're international.
Yep, we are. We added that one recently. So, the topic today to get right here. All right. The topic today is the interwar period, failed states, and how the interwar period led to the tyranny of today. Because when you do a history show channel with, when you do a history show with Bill Buford, you always... The topic is always something in history and how it led to the tyranny of today. Because
if you don't know where you've been, you can't possibly know where you are.
Yeah. And a lot of people in America think that history began on September 11th, 2000, 2001, which is ridiculous. Well,
the people who like to torture people do.
And the people who are convinced by the torturers that they do. Which one of the Nazi bigwigs in World War II said something to the effect of, like, the average farmer just wants to, you know, hang out with his family and farm and live a life. And he doesn't want to go to war. And to get him to go to war, you have to tell him someone's attacking his way of life.
I don't know if I'm convinced by that. And the reason is because in my rather deep reading of history, and I just got finished reading Adam Hochschild's book on World War I, which talked a whole lot about the UK and US anti-war movements, peace movements, anarchists, those kinds, you discover that probably 99% of the population was stung by war fever and it stuck until the war was over.
Hmm. Yeah, people do get swept into that stuff. I mean, the easiest thing to remember in my life is that when I was a kid during the Cold War, we were taught to hate Russians, not just hate Russia, but hate Russians. Like, you know, I mean, I can't imagine what would have happened if a Russian, you know, family had moved to our town in the middle of the year and, you know, had one of them had gone to our school. Like, the kid would have gotten beaten up. There was that much anti-Russian technology. And now it's like, or anti-Russian sentiment. And now it's like, you know, I meet somebody from Russia. I'm like, oh, interesting. Tell me about where you're from, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, Russia has a top marginal tax rate of 16% instead of
40%. Wow.
Good God. That tells you something.
Yeah. So the interwar period is the period between World War I and World War II from about 1919 to 1939. And not a lot of people talk about it, and you don't learn much about it in, you know, government school. And so we're going to visit upon it. So, Bill, tell us about the interwar. Great-grandpa, tell us about the interwar period. You weren't alive, but go on.
You know, the thing that I want to press home to everybody is that I am not of the opinion, nor is Neil Ferguson and a number of other historians and historical observers, that World War I and World War II are distinctly different conflicts. I happen to think that there was an interregnum between 1919 and 1936, one could say 1933 when Hitler was elected, that's when the war actually began anew, but it wasn't really a new war. The reason I say that is because in 1914, when that young prince of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was murdered
Franz
by the alleged...
Ferdinand?
That's right.
Yes.
Was allegedly assassinated by an alleged anarchist. That's what set the powder to burn. Well, one of the reasons that powder burned is because so many of these countries had formed alliances with one another where they would where if Belgium is invaded by the Germans, the British and the French will come in on the side of the Belgians. If the following happens to the Russians, the Japanese will do this and do that. What's interesting about this is recently, just to show you how this sort of rifts in history, when the Ukraine was invaded by Russia, or parts of the Ukraine were invaded by Russia, what you had was a 1996 agreement between the U.S. and the U.K. and the Ukraine, in which they agreed in memorandum that if Russia invaded, they would come to the Ukraine's assistance. Of course, that hasn't happened. And what you see throughout history is that some countries will sign on to these and they won't honor them. Other countries will sign on to that and they will honor them. World War I is an example of that. You know, here we are at the 100th anniversary of the start of this war. And what an incredibly complex and stupid conflict that was fought between 1914 and 1918 and the effect that it had on all of these countries. Here's an interesting factoid for everybody. In 1918, all French men between the ages of 20 and 32, half of them were dead.
Wow.
In Serbia, 27% of the population, not the men, 27% of the population is estimated to have perished during that conflict. Now, let's also remember that the Ottomans and the Austro-Hungarian Empire used the Serbians because the alleged anarchist was allegedly a Serbian nationalist. I say allegedly because all of this stuff is really lost and contested in the fog of history.
Yeah, and the idea of a false flag was not invented post 9/11.
Pre-9/11, right?
There were false flags going back to the Romans.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, yeah.
Exactly. There were false flags going back to Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
Mesopotamia, most likely.
But they were pretty common. They've been pretty common in the past couple hundred years.
Absolutely.
And especially the past hundred year.
Yeah. So, years. And I set the start of World War II, which is simply the second part of World War I, at 1933 because of the election of Hitler. in what happened as a result of the Treaty of Versailles, where the Germans were forced not only to pay outlandishly disproportionate repatriation and funding to the countries they had allegedly invaded and such, but they were also forced to demilitarize. They were also forced to do things that no other country had to do after that conflict was over. And all of this set the stage for what would happen in 1933. For instance, one can speculate that the Central Powers, being Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire and a number of other smaller countries that joined together in what was the axis of the World War I, the Central Powers versus the Allies, they were the ones who not only provided the sealed train for Lenin so that he could go to the very troubled Russian frontier and start his Bolshevik, and some of them started the Menshevik revolution at the time. What would have happened if unconditional surrender weren't demanded of the Germans? What would have happened if they said, you need to cede the following lands, but we want to meet at the table and figure out what's going to happen? I suspect, and this is sheerly speculative, that Adolf Hitler probably would have been a second-rate art dealer, and a nice artist, by the way, if you look at some of his paintings.
I've never seen his paintings. They're not easy to find. They probably are now on the internet, but I was told in high school that he was a failed artist, but they didn't have a picture of any of his art. They wanted to keep him a failed artist.
That, you know, with the exception of well-paid actors, though, Michael, as you're well aware, having been a musician yourself, failed artists, that's redundant when you say that.
Well, that's...
You know, if you're expecting remuneration for what you're going to do as an artist...
Yeah, then there's the flip side of that attitude, what Ian MacKay said in DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist is, people say, what's it like to be a successful artist? And he said, if you're an artist, you're succeeding at it if you're doing it. The first time I wrote a song and played it with my friends in the basement for nobody, I was a successful artist. So there you go, man.
I think that's a great riposte.
Freedom Fiends, succeeding at radio. We'll be back.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio worms.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most of our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Dropping truth bombs of history in your lap and then running away. No, we're not violent. We carry guns, but we're not violent. And I just want to brag for a minute that nobody has ever done what we're doing on here, is given some hardcore history without a pro-state agenda. You know, people don't do this kind of stuff on radio. I mean, they may, you know, if you listen to Rush or Hannity, they'll talk a little bit occasionally about World War One or Two. Not Hannity. Hannity's a jock. Hannity was a football player. He was a sportscaster. I don't think he can even read, probably.
He's paralyzed from the neck up.
Yeah. But, you know, Limbaugh has cracked a book, and he's right about 30% of the time and incredibly wrong about 70% of the time. He's basically, the time he's good is when he's talking about his personal stories of how he brought himself up by his bootstraps from nothing. That I can listen to. But, you know, whenever they give history stuff, it's always so Americocentric. It's so ethnocentric. It's so xenophobic. It's so, we're number one because I was born here and I was told that. And, you know, there's really not a context of history. I don't think anyone has ever done, you know, a full 2-hour show on the interwar period on radio, unless it was NPR, and then they had a real statist agenda, a real left agenda, and they're probably, you know, you have to listen to like clanking dishes in the background because they do all the man on the street interviews, which are actually fine, and they're newsy, but they fake some of them. I believe they fake some of them because they actually have a book. It's like the produce. It's called like a guide to audio journalism or something by NPR. And I read it. There's things that not, I don't think they fake stuff, but there's a lot of good stuff in there about journalism. If you ignore about radio journalism, if you ignore the state loving aspect of it and the left loving aspect of it. So whenever someday when we are the number one Liberty show, the number one radio show in the world on every station, and you know, they interview me and say on NPR and say, how did you get so great? And I'll say, I read your book, you magnificent bastards, which is a World War II joke. Okay. So, I was thinking about the Axis idea, you know, the enemies were the Axis in World War II.
Right. In World War II, they would call them the Axis, and they were the Central Powers. In World War I, the Germans were the Central Powers, and then in World War II,
were they called the
Germans
or
the Axis powers?
They weren't called the Axis in World War I, right?
They were not.
Okay, but the term Axis of Evil. I'm trying to do my George W. Bush imitation. Axis of Evil. you know, they use the same term for a different set of enemies, which also is going to lead into, we're going to talk about failed states in hour two, and there are some so-called failed states in the Axis of Evil. So why does America always have to have an enemy, and whatever you want to say about axes and evil and the interwar period?
Look, America has to have an enemy because America has been at war for 85% of its entire history since its formation under the Constitution in 1791 with one foe or another, whether it's the extermination campaigns of American Aboriginals or starting in 1893 with the annexation of Hawaii up until this very day. America has waged war on the world, and that's just what it does because America is a hyper-military power that can't help but flex its muscles on a consistent basis.
You forgot Eurasia. We've been at war with Eurasia. We've always been at war with Eurasia.
You can say that if you want.
That's a 1984 reference. All right, so go on. I'll just shut up.
You don't have to shut up, Michael. It's your show. But when we look at World War I, what we see is we see this race really expanding exponentially, this acceleration into warfare and this kind of globalized warfare really taking off. After World War I, pretty much with the exception of a lot of forays into South America, Latin America, and the Spanish colonies that were repatriated in 1898, from the Philippines to Cuba and everything in between of the Spanish colonies as the Spanish Empire collapsed, it pretty much kept America busy between 1918 and 1941 when it entered World War II. And so it wasn't as if America had stopped its militarism. It had just localized its militarism. It had, I think, like the, and I'll be able to stipulate this by researching it on a break, I think it had the 6th or the 11th largest army on planet Earth at the time on the eve of World War II. And I'm going to correct that in the next segment when I take a look after the break. But it had a small one compared to European armies and such. Of course, at the end of World War II, that wasn't quite the case. It had a very large army that it had to demobilize. But I think with this whole Axis thing, America always has to have an enemy. And one of the reasons America has to have an enemy, well, actually it's twofold. The number one reason America has to have an enemy is it's good for government.
What's number two, real quick?
Number two is it's big for money.
We'll be back with our coverage of the military-industrial complex after this trip to the free market on the Freedom Fiends.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net. Shows our wall-to-wall ads. We have a lot of ads, but that's because a lot of them are the network and the radios the local affiliates ads. And we generally give our ads away to nonprofits and not-for-profits and people like antiwar.com, which you should check out. And we never do what they call live reads in the biz, what they call live reads, which is, you know, where Hannity will be like, and I think we should bomb these Muslims back to the Stone Age. You know what else is Stone Age? Having hard water. Go to Billy Bob's soft water filter, you know, like that kind of thing. They do bad segues and then they talk during the segment. Like there's all the ad segments and then they talk during the segment. I never do that, but I'm going to do that. But it's not product. It's not company specific. I'm going to say I was having a lot of back problems and I did a couple of things and I'm not even going to say like go to this company because there's different solutions for it. And one I didn't even need a company for. One was done with stuff in my house. I set up two computer monitors and one is a giant flat screen TV using an HDMI cable at standing level so I can stand and use the computer. And then I have another one that's a regular big flat screen, you know, computer monitor, smaller one, so I can sit. So I'm not sitting all day. So, and I'm standing doing the show too. The other thing I did was a tip from Bill Bupert, who has dealt with back issues and conquered them to an extent. I went on Amazon, spent $30 and ordered one of those 30-inch exercise balls.
Excellent.
But I'm not sitting on it. Bill said to use it as a seat. I found that far too wobbly. But I'm using it to like roll around on my back when I take breaks from the computer. And it's not only fun, it's strengthening my back and I really like it. So thank you, Bill.
Well, certainly. And you and your wife can have fun with it later on, too.
Hey, this is a family-friendly show. And, you know, that's how families happen is, you know, mommies and daddies who love each other very much rolling around on an exercise ball. Okay, so we had our crackhead research team, I mean, our crack research team fact-check Bill's wild and drunken boasts. No, he's not drunk. That was a few weeks ago.
That was a few weeks ago with Boston and Ernie Hancock. Yeah.
I never asked you. Did you ever listen to that?
I did. It was excellent. I really enjoyed it.
It was the most fun, liberty-oriented radio that's ever happened. I don't think there was any useful information in it other than like these guys that everyone thinks are really serious, you know, and are really smart and are kind of like leaders in the libertarian community, if that's a contradiction. But people that are smart that people read their books and look up to. Can have fun, man. People were like, wow, I've never heard those guys laugh. Although Ernie laughs all the time, but you know, you and Boston. Does. Yeah, it was amazing. So were you right? Or do we have to catapult you into the next county?
No, you have to catapult me into the next county. And I thank your crack research team for giving me this correction. I was speculating on what it would be, but apparently June 30th, 1939, there were 187,000 active duty Army soldiers in the U.S. Army, and it was ranked 19th in the world, just behind Portugal.
Okay, you said it was like 9th, right, or something?
I did, and it turns out to be 19th.
But it wasn't anywhere near number one, which is what it is now. We're number one. We have
not in the least.
Yeah.
Now, this is an army, though, that expanded in 6 years, that by May 1945 had 8.3 million active duty soldiers.
Now, didn't the military industrial complex, as we know it today, start ramping up around World War One?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there is no doubt in my mind that it did. Here's an interesting factoid that I always throw around to people to show them why the government loves war so much. In 1917... The national debt, the acknowledged national debt, because we know the government cooks its books, was about $500 million. By the end of 1918, it had ballooned to approximately $4 billion or something like that. So it was amazing from 1917 to 1918 how much it increased.
They cooked the books that we know about. That's just the books we know about. There's other books we don't even know about.
Well, you know, it's the War Revenue Act of 1917 that did it because it lowered exemptions. It greatly increased tax rates. By the way, this is a mere 4 years after the income tax because in 1917, a taxpayer with only $40,000 faced a 16% rate, yet an individual with $1.5 million faced a tax rate of 67%. Now, by 1918, that has started to increase. As a matter of fact, The time at that time, the bottom rate was 6%, the top rate was 77%. And those changes increased revenue from $761 million in 1916 to $3.6 billion in 1918. So what you had was you had an almost 8 times increase within 2 years' time, where, and that was 25% of the GDP at the time. That's a lot of money. And what that means is that the government gets control of that money, not only through the tax code, not only through putting funded debt as a burden on the unborn progeny, but it's a way for them to leverage yet more regulations against the population itself. Of course, there were anarchist, anti-war activists, peace activists in World War I and World War II. Wilson comes up with the American Protective League, which had hundreds of thousands of members, both deputized, but they were government agents. They were people who volunteered to be informants in Stukai, and they were going after people who objected to America entering this continental conflict in 1917.
Yeah.
So the government loves war. When you rocket forward to World War II, you see that 1943, Milton Friedman not only gives us income tax withholding, but we have a top marginal income tax rate in America of 94%. 94%. This is a mere generation and a half after the income tax amendment is in place.
Yeah. And Americans, well, people everywhere are brainwashed that everything their government is doing is good because,
oh my gosh,
because mainstream media. I actually just got, while you were talking, proof of that. Okay. You know Nick Hazelton, the 16-year-old wonder kid that's one of the hosts on this show?
Yeah.
And he's getting college high school credit for being on our show. So his grandfather listened to the show, who's kind of a, you know, Tea Party kind of guy, and suddenly started like writing Nick and CCing Nick's dad and me and telling Nick why everything on the show is wrong.
Oh, that's interesting.
And we were talking about, you know, the police industrial complex and the war industrial complex. And I just got an email back from him that says, to provide a little balance, here's an alternate view from the major news networks. And he put two YouTube links. Alternate view from the major networks is a hilarious and wrong statement.
Isn't that interesting where people have that kind of, it's like when I hear the National Pinko Radio folks complaining because all of a sudden there's right, alleged right-wing talk radio out there. There are shows like yours. There's the interwebs that have all of this alternative libertarian media on there. And the FCC and the usual suspects in the awful office and the executive agencies are very concerned about the amount of people who are out there talking about these kind of things. And they should be balanced because, to me, NPR, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, they all say the same thing. They're government supremacist house organs that are Goebbels gargling.
Yeah.
That's what they do for a living.
Yeah, and the there has been a lot of gnashing of teeth over the past 20 or 25 years by liberals basically demanding that the government get rid of right-wing media to an extent and give some of that airwave and space and free government money to the left. And here's the thing. It's already, if you buy into the ridiculous concept that left and right are diametrically opposed and they're the only two choices, the left already has a bigger share of the media than the right. And
they own all the academic media.
Yeah.
99% of the academic media.
Yeah, absolutely. And the right dominates talk radio, and the right has Fox News, which is really socialist right. It's neocon. It's not true conservative. You still there, Bill?
I am.
Bill's playing with his microphone.
I was playing with it for a reason. Well, I'll tell you.
It's fun. Air. It's fun. You were making weird body noises, I'll bet.
What I did want to say, though, was that this whole left-right paradigm is a false paradigm that the government and in academia enjoys. To me, it's between collectivist and individualist. You're either a non-interventionist individualist or you're an interventionist collectivist. That's yeah, where you are.
Yeah.
But you know, for instance, did you see all the people who were saying that the grand old Politburo won for the House and the Senate for 2015? And they're saying freedom will ring. Well, no, it won't. If you look at the awful office, the House and the Senate from 2000 to 2006, freedom didn't ring during that time under the auspices of the GOP.
Yeah, but let me put on my statist hat for a minute here and pretend that those people are correct, that in their false claim that there's only left and right, they are opposites, and that, sure, you know, you have to pick a side. The thing about right-wing radio, or the, you know, talk radio, and that's the place that the left always, you know, every 10 years or so, they try to put something into a bill in Congress to, like, quash right-wing radio. And I really believe what's going to happen is that the next president's going to be Hillary, because, you know, people are stupid and they didn't learn from any of the other presidents. But not that anyone is better than the other, but she's particularly horrible. I think she is going to kick all of the right-wing radio off the air. And, you know, the two libertarian shows, us and Free Talk Live. I don't think they're going to kick us off the air, because that would be, it would seem too police state-y and too obvious. And, you know, somebody might say it's a violation of the First Amendment. And, you know, the ACLU might actually back the right wingers and go to court for free speech on that one. But I think she's just going to put us all on at night, when there's less people awake and a lot of the stations have to power down to not interfere with others because of the AM skip off the stratosphere. And then I think she's going to fill daytime radio with community programming. She's going to say syndicated radio doesn't serve the community, because there's actually this rare little thing that no one notices in the FCC regulations, that stations should serve their community. So I think she's going to replace all the daytime, you know, big talk radio shows with, like, kids from the local high school coming in with the AV club and doing, you know, pieces, interviewing the local police on why they needed to get a Bearcat and why they need three more, you know, why they need a tank.
I think it's entirely possible that that can happen, but the internet is moving by leaps and bounds. Yeah. And most people, yeah, especially young people, the millennials and such, and myself, consume all of our news off the internet. And the internet's a very volitional media device, unlike a television, where you have a limited selection. It is unlimited on the internet. So I think it may cut it off at the pass to a certain extent.
There's always going to be a market for people talking in an interesting way, like we're doing, no matter what the delivery method is, which is why I'm training you guys in the teaching hospital that is the Freedom Fiends. Worms.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's Antiwar.com. Do you believe in free speech? Jay Raven had her True Shives YouTube channel taken down. We believe this censorship was wrong, and we believe the channel is a clear example of free speech. Many people are bullied on the internet, but Jay Raven actually stood up to the bullying. She has filed a self-defense lawsuit against the individuals who took down the channel. The outcome of this suit could be very important to the future of free speech. Learn more at TrueShibes.com. That's Tango, Romeo, Uniform, Sierra, Hotel, India, Bravo, Echo, Sierra.com. TrueShibes.com. Freedom Fiends, the war horse to end all war horses. So we're, you know, on Freedom Fiends, we are all tangents all the time. And we're going to come back to war horses and the interwar period and the failed horse project. We're going to talk about failed states. And when we say failed states, we're not talking about the failed state project, which is the city of Detroit. But I want to talk a little more about right-wing radio. You know, the thing is, like, I don't really love a lot of right-wing radio. I hate left-wing radio. You know, they left-wingers get it wrong almost all the time. Right-wingers get it wrong two-thirds of the time because they're playing in a false paradigm. But here's the thing. The reason that right-wing conservative talk dominates heavily dominates radio, AM talk radio, and a little bit of FM talk radio too, but is because Because left wingers are horrible at it and right wingers are really, really good at it, man. The right wingers, when they go on, you know, the good ones, the ones that are well known, when they go on a tear of invective against the left, it shakes you to your boots. Like, regardless of what they're saying, they have conviction. They can really talk. When left wingers go on a tear against the right on radio, they sound whiny, man. They're just not good at it. The market has spoken. It's not a government conspiracy. It's not a vast right-wing Koch brothers conspiracy. It's just that the left aren't very good at it.
I agree completely. There was Air America where, you know, a number of them got, I wouldn't be surprised if there was government subsidy in there somewhere. But they have these hosts who include that senator from Minnesota now.
Al Franken.
Al Franken, the former comedian.
Like, you know, what gave him the background to be a senator or congressman, which is he? Senator, right?
He's a senator.
Was playing, you know, he's not like, I'm not a politician, but I've played one on Saturday Night Live. I mean, that was his resume, basically.
I think it's perfectly appropriate because I think there is no real means to become a good politician if you're not a venal and psychopathic human being.
And a good actor.
And a good actor, with the exception of Ron Paul.
Yeah.
Who I think... But of course, Ron Paul wasn't a very good politician.
Well, he wasn't a good politician. He was the only good politician, the only true man who like actually played by the rules of the Constitution and cared about liberty. The only one in the history of America, I would say. But
there's not a lot of successful libertarian talk show hosts. Like I used to listen to when I had XM, which I no longer have. I used to listen to this cat named Jason Lewis.
Yeah.
Who imitated a libertarian rather well. But then there's the fellow from Georgia who he's all about the fair tax. What's his name?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. That guy.
You know who I'm talking about?
He's retired. That guy. That guy's retired from radio.
But not only that, but he's a militarist, just like Leonard Peikoff with The Objectivist. You know, he's the guy who says, yeah, torture's cool. War on the world is cool. Well, how in the heck are you a libertarian? I mean, what are your libertarian credentials? I'm hard-pressed to think of a successful nationwide libertarian talk show excepting The Fiends, which is making a footprint like an oil spot.
Free Talk Live are the real deal. And they're on 100. We're on 34 stations. They are on 165 stations.
And they do a great job.
You gotta mention them in that. Yeah. There's only two shows doing what we're doing. You know, that book I was talking about, the I read your book, you magnificent bees, the NPR guide to audio journalism or something like that.
It's Patton who said that. I read your book when he was talking about Rommel.
Yeah. That was my World War II reference. Or was that World? That was, yep.
World War II. Yep. Patton was in World War II, Michael.
Thank you. I went to government school. But there's a story in that book that's true that tells about why left-wing radio was failed from the start. Like they finally had Air America. They finally had their own network and it was a big deal. The first show of the first day, the flagship was Al Franken because he was a comedian from Saturday Night Live. People knew who he was. And he was supposed to go do his first show. They had a big shiny new office building with like, you know, cable internet all piped in back when that was a new thing. You know, they spent millions and millions of dollars building this building and hiring everybody and training everybody. He's about to do his first show. You can't smoke in the building. This is before it was illegal to smoke in buildings, but it was a lefty building, so you had to go outside to smoke. He went outside to have a cigarette, but right before his show, and he got locked out. And he missed the first 4 or 5 minutes of his first show because he was outside banging on the other side of a fire door. Yeah, that was really a lot of foreshadowing of where that ship was sinking to.
But you look at the success of Rush Limbaugh, for instance, who I think, like Hannity, isn't the sharpest stick in the quiver, but he knows media, he knows performance, he knows entertainment, and he knows how to appeal to a crowd. And you can't appeal to a crowd and be principled at the same time.
Yep. And we'll be back with hour two of the Freedom Fiends for the failed horse project, talking about the history of war in America, including the interwar period, and a bit on failed states and what that really means. Really, they're all failed states, but... Admit it. You hate shopping for Christmas. You do. It's a hassle coupled with a burden, mechanically checking off friends, relatives, and coworkers from your list. You're probably not even religious, but if you are, is buying your cousin some little made-in-China piece of plastic really celebrating the birth of your savior? This holiday season, why buy gifts for friends and relatives? Most of them are status anyway. You should send that money to the Freedom Fiends instead. The Freedom Fiends will use your money to help spread education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. If you want to help provide inoculation from indoctrination, go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post to send your money to the Fiends instead. Because buying crap for unappreciative statist relatives won't get your name on the golden floppy disk of redemption. And if you must shop for Christmas, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you anything extra, and Amazon will save you the danger of holiday drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon pretty much sells everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom, so get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reindoctrination Center's low orbit ion cannon. High atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite Libair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. My name's not important. Only what we say is important. But I'm talking to Bill Buford from ZeroGov.com. You know, I used to say a lot whenever Bill was on. Are you there, Bill?
I'm right here.
Yeah, I used to say a lot when Bill was on that Bill is a retired Army officer. And he always goes, ugh, you don't have to say that.
You always have to say that.
Yeah.
It's like you're obsessed.
Yeah, because he said something like, you know, I heard someone thank you for your service once, and you were like, why? They paid me.
Not only did they pay me, but I've made you much less safe than you would have been if America's military might hasn't been screwing around with the world for 150 years.
And you did a good job. You're not saying you messed things up and made the world less safe. You're saying you did your job and did it well and made the world less safe.
Well, indeed I did.
Yep. So we were talking about money in the first part of the show. We're talking about things you can buy on Amazon, things you can buy. And one thing I didn't mention, I want to do a little live read for the fiends here. If you like this show, go do some of your Christmas shopping on Amazon through the Freedom Fiends affiliate link. It doesn't cost you anything extra, and we get a little bit of money to keep the show running and pay our server fees and pay expenses. And you can go to freedomfiends.com. That's freedom, then Foxtrot, Echo, November, Sierra.com. And over on the right, there's an Amazon affiliate link. And if you click on that and then do your shopping, we get a taste. And it's a good place to do Christmas shopping. They sell everything. Everything except guns and weed, but they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom, which you can also get from gunsandweed.com. So, Bill, we were talking about war and the failed states and things and war horses and the interwar period. We're going to get back to that. I want to take a quick detour to tell you, I don't know if you've had a chance to catch up on this, but Freedom Fiends is completely changing our format soon. We're going to become an unofficial fan podcast on the radio 24/7, every show of the week, or 2/7, I guess it would be, for a fan podcast for the show Walking Dead. Did you get that memo?
I did not get that memo.
I'm kidding. It's just that a bunch of the people are huge fans, and Davi and I are doing a three episode trilogy last night. Or no, it's already up. It was last week, and there were three segments. It was Night of the Living Worms, Dawn of the Worms, and Day of the Worms. And it was all zombies. It was all zombies all the time.
Well,
and
I saw your Day of the Dead homage on the Freedom Fiends website. So if people go there, they'll see the main zombie character from Day of the Dead.
Yeah. Yep.
Romero's third installment in his zombie trilogy, which turned into a quadrilogy, I think.
You know, this is kind of
quint trilogy.
Well, there was a prequel for our three Freedom Fiends trilogy, and we're not really turning into a pop culture podcast that never discusses politics, but we just like to take a break once in a while. But this is an interesting little thing. Timothy Leary Futique, F-U-T-I-Q-U-E, which is the Twitter feed run by Timothy Leary's estate, just tweeted the Freedom Fiends. This is kind of interesting. And it actually
that is very cool.
Yeah, it's like, and it's not just like his kids or something. It's like an organization that he put in trust of like making decisions of whether, you know, like one of his books is used for to make a movie or, you know, everything about his archives is run by Timothy Leary Futique. And they just tweeted the other day, steal this book, Black Panthers, Leary, Weather Underground, CIA crack, heroin, and then a link to a Freedom Fiends episode. And then it says American Top 40. I'm honored by that, man.
It sounds like an acid-infused and influenced ad campaign.
Yeah. Oh, and the episode they linked was "Are Those Who Do Not Remember the Past Are Condemned to Repeat It, Part 2," which was an episode where we talked about Jim Jones, COINTELPRO, the Watts Riot, white privilege, George Moscone, Harvey Milk, Steal This Book, Black Panthers, Timothy Leary, Weather Underground, CIA crack, heroin in the 70s, self-defense organizations, Waco, Martin Luther King, Ruby Ridge, and a whole bunch of other interesting stuff. So, you know, sometimes we talk about zombies for three whole shows in a row, and sometimes we give like hardcore history lessons. And we're giving a hardcore history lesson today with Bill Buford talking about the interwar period, which is the period that not a lot of people know about between World War I and World War II in American history and world history. I think you wanted to talk about war horses or something, didn't you? The horse
well,
to
I did
end
briefly
all wars.
Because during World War I, from 1914 to 1918, there were a lot of stalwarts to include the British Field Marshal, John French, who said that we can win this war with the horse to show you just how backwards and anachronistic and still fighting the last war in 1870, all of them were. Well, it turns out because of the lack of maneuver warfare and the propensity for attrition warfare, trench warfare, the horse not only didn't see that happen, but the horse was replaced in 1917 by the tank. But nonetheless, there was a horse culture that imbued itself into the American Army in the interwar years up until 1939. As a matter of fact, the last American cavalry charge took place in 1942 in the Philippines, and the British didn't retire the cavalry lance from their order of equipment until 1923. And what that goes to show you is that the military tends to fight the last war that they fought, and yeah, the same thing happened in the first 3 years of World War II until technology really started to gain traction, and we would see things like all of these fighter bomber aviation advancements that were made, where you had the ME-262 German jet by the end of the conflict. You had Norden bomb sites. Of course, you had the nuclear bomb.
And you had the AK-47 after the war was over.
Which was heavily influenced, of course, by the SMGs and the 44 series that was fielded by the Wehrmacht, which shot a sub-rifle caliber round. And the Russians, by the way, it's so interesting you bring that up about the Kalashnikov. There's a book out there by Don Shivers called The Gun, in which he shows, ironically enough, that when the Kalashnikov was adapted in 1947, like you just said, it was adopted using a capitalist means with competing armament factories in the Soviet Union to come up with the best design. Did that happen for the Colt Eugene Stoner design for the M16?
No.
It did not. That was a stovepiped military industrial complex fixed auction and selection campaign that gave us that weapon, and that rifle was really a piece of garbage up until the 1990s.
The 47?
Not the 47, the M16.
Oh, the Stoner. Yeah, it was the thing that jammed and got people killed
exactly,
in Vietnam all
because
the time.
It wasn't chrome lined, because it was a direct impingement system. It didn't have a forward feed mechanism. You had rounds that were just awful. The sighting system was rickety. I mean, it was just a mess. But I would suggest this. Since the late 90s, the M4 successor in the U.S. Armed Forces to the M16 and the Marine Corps variants and such,
it is
the best of breed rifle. Yeah. It does.
Although I don't have one, and I do have an AK-47. I have a Yugo one, Yugo 70s from the 70s.
Yeah.
The cutting edge of Serbo-Croatian technology, as they said about the Yugo car in the movie Dragnet.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is, interestingly, that weapon, you know, my AK is made in the same factory that the Yugo car is made in. which goes to point out, you know, the worst car that was ever released in the West was made in where one of the best rifles was made. Same
ironically
factory.
Enough.
You know, and the Yugos are prized. Those ones are prized. They're chromed. I think they're chromed. There's a lot about them that are superior to most of the Russian and Chinese ones, and they are sought after. Here's the interesting thing, though. They didn't just spread the AK, ironically, the right arm of capitalism, of the right arm of communism. They didn't only spread that gun with capitalism. They also spread it with like open sourcing technology before that term even existed, because they did patent the design. They did trademark the design. They did keep it, you know, close to their vest, but they gave the blueprints to any country that was remotely either communist or against America, you know, or against the powers of the West.
In the Soviet bloc, and the Western powers did the same thing. When you look at the Israeli Galil was also manufactured in Guatemala at licensed factories. When you look at the HK-91 out of Germany, you had it licensed in factories in Spain and in Portugal. And then when you look at the Galil variation in South Africa, because Israel and South Africa, up until the late 90s, when the new administration came on board, had a very close and tight relationship because they found themselves in the same pariah status. They designed something called the R1, which was simply a Galil that had a stock that was an inch longer because people South African armed forces tended to be taller and a little stockier.
Now, wait, the Galil, is that the one that's the Franken rifle between the AK and the AR, or is it the AK and the FAL? I forget.
No, you're right. It is. But if you look at it, it has a FAL buttstock on it.
Yeah, there is a FAL that is extra long for Africans, too.
The R1.
Yeah, yep.
Yep, because the R1 variant was both a Galil and there was an FAL that did the same. I may have it confused where the FAL variant is the R1, but the Galil was used down there as a standard rifle. And they would use 50-round magazines with them because they were a mechanized army.
I guarantee that Hesperius will correct us whether we got that right or not. We have some hardcore gun fans who know every detail of every weapon ever made, and within minutes of the show, like during the show, he'll probably send me an email.
Here's what I'm going to stand by then, that the FAL was an R1 and that the Galil was licensed to be produced by the South Africans under whatever name they called it.
I had a FAL and actually got rid of it because I'm 5'5", and even the standard DSA FAL was too big for me.
I had six of them, and we don't have any longer, and my oldest son still has his.
Yeah. Yeah. I like what Boston said about it. He said something like, it's an amazing rifle considering it was made by a country whose military history consists solely of waving Germans through the border.
Boston just has a way with words, I'm telling you. Boston's Gun Bible, both the original and the revised copies, has been on my nightstand on and off for years.
Yep, and that's Boston Tea Party. And we did an interview last week, or 2 weeks ago, where Boston and Bill were drinking, and it was a really fun episode, so go find that if you want. So real quick, let's set it up for the next segment here, War Horses.
So what? It was just interesting to me that the stirrup had been the revolution in military affairs 2,000 years ago, and over that 2,000 years, the horse in Western warfare was the centerpiece of maneuver warfare. There was no other. But then again, we can go back to the Caesar's invasion of Gaul, and you see what cavalry does for them.
Yeah, and they still call them cavalry, but they're not on horses anymore. And, you know, it's basically every war, they say they have the technology to end all wars, and it never does. And now they're dealing with people who are using medieval weapons and World War II weapons, and they don't know how to deal with that.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Having outgrown childish libertarian fantasies, I now believe in worms! What is Libertarians Against Humanity? It's the only unofficial Cards Against Humanity expansion pack by libertarians, for libertarians, and against libertarians. Libertarians Against Humanity is free to play online, or join the Indiegogo campaign to get physical copies and other perks to play with friends or status you haven't defued yet. Because if we don't laugh, the status win.
Not recommended for faint heart, thin skins, or those who easily rustle jimmies. Consult a physician if you experience a drop in blood pressure or laughter lasts longer than 4 hours.
That's libertariansagainsthumanity.com.
Freedom Fiends. And we're going to hijack our own conversation. And I'm going to point out that Tim O'Reilly of O'Reilly Media, a company that I sometimes do tech writing for pay, that's part of my day job. He once said that artists have more to fear from obscurity than they do from copyright violation. And they walk that talk at O'Reilly, and they sell tech books, those cool tech books that every nerd has a bunch of them on his bookshelf that are all about programming and web convergence and web 9.0 and things like that. Yeah. You know, they always have an animal on the cover, and their checks have a tarsier on them. That's kind of fun. But it's a really good point. Artists have more to fear from obscurity than they do from copyright violation. And a really good example of that is Timothy Leary, who old guys like us know who he is, but the youngsters don't really know what's up with him. And here's the thing. That guy was a lot more than the guru of LSD. That was the smallest part of what he was. That's what he's known for, because the press liked that. But that guy was very forward-thinking. He was almost a no-government man. He was doing the best with what he could. He was very futuristic, very forward-thinking in a very brilliant way. The guy was on computers before most people knew what they were, in his home. The guy was, you know, sending things to his publisher over a modem before there was an internet or to speak of. And he was on the internet very early on as he was dying around that time. He had somebody set it up. He webcast his death. Do you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah. He died of cancer in his home, surrounded by loved ones in 1996 at age 75. And they webcast it. There's video. There was live video streamed on the internet, and there is video of it. Yeah, he was a very forward-thinking guy, but he made a mistake. And here's the mistake: was when he was dying in 1996, and the internet wasn't what it is now, and there wasn't the idea of Creative Commons, there wasn't the idea of open-sourced everything. He had many books, many published manuscripts, many photos, like a lifetime of his work, and he wanted to share it with the world. So he willed it to the New York Public Library.
Oh, no.
I have a friend, because that's what you did in his era of his life that's what an academic or a great man did, to preserve his papers was, willed them to a university library or a public library, a well-known public library.
Yeah.
I have a friend that is making a documentary about Timothy Leary, and he's running into a lot of, like, he has permission from Leary's estate to do it, but he's having trouble getting the source material he needs from the New York Public Library.
I'm not surprised at all, because it's a government entity. Yeah, so what are they going to do?
So if he'd lived a couple more years, he probably would have made a different decision and just, had five close friends who are internet savvy scan everything and dump it on the internet for all to use. Yeah. And it just goes back to that thing of like, you have more. And it wasn't really a copyright issue, but it's like the New York Public Library, you have to go through a bureaucratic usage issue to get anything from him, and go through a bunch of, for each document you want to get, you have to fill out a bunch of paperwork for each document and pay a scanning fee.
Of course you do.
I've actually done that once in making the documentary Hubert Selby Jr. It'll Be Better Tomorrow. He had willed a bunch of his papers, or actually given them to him while he was still alive. He gave a bunch of his letters to, I think it was the Stanford Library, Stanford, California. And they were pretty cool about letting me use it. I had a letter from his widow who said, yeah, please let Michael Dean use this stuff to scan. But yeah. I had to request it and pay a $1 per page scanning and mailing fee. And then
that sounds like the courthouse.
Yeah. And then wait about 3 weeks,
Yeah. Yep.
So if you want to be remembered, don't worry about making money. Don't worry about copyrights. Don't worry about licensing. Put everything on the internet and I would recommend a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license, which is basically anyone can use it with attribution in any way, remixing it or not, in perpetuity for commercial or non-commercial use without having to write you. And if you go to the Freedom Fiend site, at the top of the page, there's a banner at the top of the page, and in that banner, it says, all Fiends audio, images, and words covered by a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. So there. It's the top of the page. It's the first thing. Like, it's bigger than the name of the show, you know?
It's astonishing to me, because then you mentioned that he went to Algeria in 1970, and that would be one of the last places on Earth I'd want to go.
Well, you know, bet like now when, you know, people do activism and like film the police and get arrested and then try to raise money on the internets, you know, and to get their bail. Timothy Leary got broken out of prison. I'm not saying people should do that. I'm just saying, like, that's how they did it in the 60s. He got broken out of prison and went to Algeria and stayed with Eldridge Cleaver.
Funny.
All right, we'll be back.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Mr. Michael Dean talking to Bill Biebert from ZeroGov.com, talking about interwar periods, war horses, Timothy Leary, failed states. We were talking about Timothy Leary. I think he was a really interesting cat. You do too, huh?
I do indeed.
Yeah. You know, I have a little map where I can see who's looking at the Freedom Fiend site at any time. Yes, I am the NSA of Liberty. Now, I just can see like where people are in the world looking. You know, I have a map. I have the big board. I actually keep it up when I'm using my two computer screens. Sometimes I keep it up on one screen, like the look on the big board to see who's looking at us. And we recently started getting a lot of hits from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, which is kind of interesting because I was like, why does that sound familiar? And I'm like, oh yeah. When I was 13, Timothy Leary was speaking at the college at Edinburgh, and I really wanted to go. And my dad was like, no way. And I still kind of resent my dad to this day for that. Like, you know, I wasn't going to go take LSD and see Timothy Leary. I just wanted to go hear him speak. I'd read his book, High Priest. I understood that he was an important, a lot of people don't know who he is, but at least go read his Wikipedia page. Timothy Leary. The world would look very different if it weren't for him. He really,
I think it would. He and Stuart Brand were sort of like stovepipes of looking forward like that.
Yep. Stuart Brand did not invent the internet, but he helped put one in every carriage house, as they said, with the car and Ford. He was the whole Earth catalog guy. And I read that when I was about 11 because my sister had left a copy in the attic when she went off to college.
I loved it.
Yeah, it was kind of like the internet. Actually, like somebody from Google called it like Google on paper before the internet.
And it was. And then they had the Coevolution Quarterly, which evolved into the Whole Earth Review, which was sort of like a monthly or quarterly continuation of the Whole Earth catalog. He runs the Long Now Foundation, where he's trying to preserve knowledge for the long term.
Yep. I do that by putting everything out Creative Commons and putting it up on torrents. And if you want to do some torrenting for the Freedom Fiends to help keep us drone-proof, go to the Freedom Fiends site and click on the Torrent Club link over on the right side. And the Whole Earth Catalog was like, it was this thing that came out about once a year from, I'm guessing like, you know, 68 to 74 or 5. And it was a giant paperback kind of printed on, giant. Like, you know.
I still have two of them.
Yeah. And it was, I say over and over, and I've never heard anyone else say that, I think that thing is the missing link between the hippies and the, you know, gun nut survivalists, because that book actually, you know, it was a lot of about living off the land. It was about building geodistic domes. I read that book and went and heard Buckminster Fuller speak, because I'd read about geodistic domes.
And I owned 8 of his books. I've heard Buckminster Fuller speak myself.
I met him. Did you meet him?
I did meet him.
Yep. That's interesting. I don't know anyone else who's met him. And he was, and the Whole Earth Catalog was like, but it, you know, it was a book for hippies, but it had a couple pages about why you should own a rifle. It had a couple pages on, and why you should learn to use it. And it had a couple pages on computers, home computers, when that wasn't even really a thing. And, you know, and there was a lot about living off the land, not being on the grid, storing food, being self-sustaining, but it had guns and it had computers. And I really think that, like, you know, when you listen to our network, GCN, when you listen to us or Free Talk Live or Alex Jones, and you hear these ads for heirloom seeds, and then the next ad is for body armor, I think that is because of the whole Earth catalog, man.
Well, you know, Jeff Berwick was fond of saying that he met anarcho-hippies as a tribe when he went to Porkfest. And I think that when you look at the road that was ahead for hippies in the late 50s and the early 60s, they had two ways to go. They could go individualist or they could go collectivist. And what they did,
they went collectivist.
Is they claimed to be individualist with their lips, but their feet took them down the collectivist path.
Yeah. I don't know if that's any of that is Timothy Leary's fault, but a lot of people who liked Timothy Leary took that path because they didn't understand how it could be done individually or in small tribes, you know, without tribalism, so to speak. But,
and I think Stuart Brand sort of pioneered that tribalism, the techno tribalism aspect of the hippie movement. He's the one who sort of gave that form and function and pushed it along and nurtured it. You see that in the Coevolution Quarterly and the Whole Earth Review. You see that in the evolution of his thinking. Now, mind you, because he was a media personality for a while, he would steel heel to what seemed to be the popular left-wing causes and such, but he always, like, you know what he reminds me of? Alexander Coburn, the left-wing writer for The Nation who wrote the column called Beat the Devil, who was always criticizing his lefty colleagues like Christopher Hitchens, because Hitchens did the same. I like that. Like, you and I as libertarians, we'll call out people who do wrong things in the libertarian movement, and you did that for 2 weeks with a certain individual.
Yeah. Did you know that Timothy Leary did a fundraiser for Ron Paul?
What?
Yep. Yep. Long, long, long time ago. Like, you know, Ron Paul's first run for president or second run for Congress or something. Yep. They kind of look alike. You ever seen a picture of them together?
They do. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm fond of saying that Ron Paul could have done something a little more if he was born with a better genetic voice register.
Yeah, man. Voice is important, and having it sound good is important. And that's why I am taking my knowledge of audio, of getting caviar sound on a cat food budget.
And creamy audio.
Creamy radio audio. Go to creamyradioaudio.com. It's my blog of how to, you know, spend $70 and sound as good as people on the radio. And it's not rocket science, but most people get it wrong. They get the wrong mic. They get the one that looks cool instead of the one that's the one to get. They put it on the table next to their computer fan. They put it 3 feet away from their mouth. They don't put a windscreen on it. That's all doing it wrong. And it's pretty easy to do it right, and I explain how. But
and I've got that mic, and I've got a windscreen, and I've got an iMac in front of me that doesn't make any noise.
Cool, man. Yeah, and you know, people feel that a lot of people look back on the 60s and feel like it was a spontaneous grassroots eruption. But what a lot of people don't know is that Timothy Leary and some of his cohorts were like strategically planning a lot of things to the point where like they were acting, you know, like a publicity agency when they didn't just like, it wasn't like Time Magazine just called and said, yeah, we want to do a story on you. It was like, okay, it's time for us to call Time. Let's make a talking points list. You know, let's decide who we're going to talk to at Time Magazine, who the photographer is going to be, you know, what the parameters are going to be, what we'll allow, what we won't, you know, him and the Beatnik poet. What was the Beatnik poet guy's name? Allen Ginsberg. Yeah, they like work together strategically, you know, like a Pepsi ad campaign or something for, you know, not just for LSD, but for enlightenment and individuality more so than just for drugs.
Advertising in the late 50s and the early 60s, I just read a book on the history of the VW bug in which really put BDD on the map as an advertising firm. And they were a minimalist advertising firm. They were an ad firm that Steve Jobs would be proud of as far as the kind of products that they boosted and the kind of way that they would put their ads together. There was one ad they put together for the bug, and 4/5 of the ad was just clean, white, with no text or pictures whatsoever.
Yeah.
That was a revolution to do that.
There's a documentary about that agency on Netflix. I'm trying to remember what it was, but it was pretty amazing. What was the name of the company? BDD?
BDD, I think. And I highly recommend. Yeah. I haven't seen that, and I'm going to look that up tonight.
Yep. And it's, we'll put it in the show notes. It before that, advertising like was just, you know, kind of like showing a picture of it and a housewife using it and saying like, it makes my husband love me more. Like they didn't really get it. It was all really like old timey, you know, like ads from the 1950s look like updated ads from the 1890s or something. But,
you know, they do. They don't make, they don't grok a knowledge connection with the product and what the product can do for the person, which is what BDD did.
And BDD even got involved with not just advertising the thing after it's out. They were involved in the design of products and services. And one of the things they did was actually changing air travel. Like before BDD, you know, taking a jet was kind of like being on a military cargo plane. You know, they were the first one that said, like, let's have stewardesses. Let's have them be pretty. Let's dress them up. Let's have them be polite. Let's, you know, let's have the ad show a family enjoying Paris. You know, like they made it an experience. And they worked with, I think it was United or was it American? It was one of the big ones.
You're right. Oh, I have to do one correction here. It's DDB, Doyle Dane Burnback.
Okay.
DDB. It's DDB with no periods, by the way. And they were one of the first advertising companies to sort of use that Bauhaus style when it came to naming themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. They were great.
They were.
Yep. So that was kind of what Leary was doing, you know, to kind of spread, I guess what they called youth culture, but, you know, it was a lot more.
I think that's an intensely interesting intellectual journey. When you look at Leary, when you look at Brand, when you look at Ginsberg, when you look at Kerouac, and you look at the people who were on the periphery of the beatnik and hippie movement through the 60s and 70s, because it did burn itself out. But I think it burned itself out because of how silly it became over time, especially when they started embracing collectivism.
Well, the state always co-opts, you know, something that they see coming out. Like another thing is the environmental movement in the 60s, you know, was not about carbon taxes. It was about, you know, voluntarily having sustainable living. And government said, oh, this is a thing. We need to get in front of this. And, you know, when you think about it, like the idea of carbon taxes and where does the money go? It's kind of hidden, too. And it's like it basically goes back into the old companies and the hegemony that's, you know, kept us from having solar powered electric cars, you know, for five decades. Yeah. But you know who invented the idea of carbon taxes? This is going to be very disappointing to you.
I do not.
Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, you're kidding me. But then again, you know what? I have to say that on reflection, a lot of my infatuation with him was a result of my adolescent intellect instead of my adult intellect.
And, you know, all children are socialists up to a certain age.
Well, I mean, that's why I think that collectivism is the creed of the adult toddler.
Yeah, because they all think everything should be free and a nanny should push everyone around and make them be good. And you can't make people be good. That's the biggest lie of the state, is the idea that, like, making things illegal makes them undesirable and not available. You know, it does the opposite.
Among many lies, because when you use the superlative of biggest when you're talking about the government, there's a lot of candidates.
Yeah, I guess that is a specious argument. All right, we're gonna go to the market and then come back for 3 minutes on failed states on the Freedom Fiends. All tangents, all the time.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, We're broadcasting this into space, into space, into space.
Now that the elections are over and liberty has slipped even further away, it's time to try yet another political organization. Campaign for a Longer Leash is a nonpartisan group of pups and dogs dedicated to fighting for longer leashes for all. We're not talking about no leashes, that would be catarchy. We just want the limited leash that the Hounding Fathers promised us. As Bone Barklin once said, a longer leash if you can keep it, ma'am. For more info, go to facebook.com/campaignforalongerleash.
Freedom Fiends, just do it. Where's the beef, man? Bill, where's the beef?
The beef is in failed states, that's what I think.
Yeah, and real quick, the name of the documentary on Netflix, it's a DVD only, they don't have it for streaming anymore. It's called Art and Copy. It's Art ampersand Copy. That's the advertising documentary where I learned a lot about the golden age of advertising in the 60s. And one of the things was the Nike Just Do It, which was is a huge worldwide advertising campaign. And it's still kind of their motto still. Do you know where that came from, Bill?
I do not.
It came from the state murdering somebody.
Interesting. Yeah. I did not do.
It was who was the guy that was executed? Was it Gary Gilmore? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was?
You sure he's not in Pink Floyd?
No,
that's David Gilmore.
David Gilmore. Yeah. Gary. His last words. You know, he was at the firing squad. I think it was in Utah. You know, with five guys pointing M1 Garands at him, about to fire. What do those things fire? What's the bullet called? 30-06. Was it 30-06?
For which weapon?
M1 Garand.
Yeah, 30-06.
Yeah, firing five guys. You know, one of them had a blank, four of them had the thing. So there's the culpable deniability. You know, in a warehouse, in a police warehouse, with bales of hay behind him. Now, in a big cement building. Now, I would not want to be in a building where four 30-06 rifle bullets are being fired at a person through hay with cement behind him. It sounds like a ricochet nightmare and very dangerous, but
absolutely,
that's how they killed him. And he wanted to be killed. And he's one of the only people on death row who's ever like, man, this is taking too long. Hurry up. And like people sued on his behalf to not have him killed. And it made him mad. He's like, come on, man, let's get this done. When he was blindfolded, tied up, about to be shot in the chest before four rifle bullets at close range, they said, do you have any last words? You know, they read the death writ and they said, do you have any last words? And he said, just do it. And that was the headline the next day in national newspapers, was just do it. And this this ad agency, Wyden and Kennedy, was hired to come up with a motto and campaign for Nike. And it was that week. They couldn't think of anything. They picked up the paper and saw, let's do it. And they said, just do it. That's going to be Nike's motto.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. Sounds apocryphal.
Yep. All right. So you got 2 minutes for failed states. Unless you want to talk about advertising, and we'll do
failed states. No, I'm going to talk about something real interesting when it comes to failed states. And that's
just
the UN.
Just do it.
The UN had a statelessness program that they put together for the first time last year, and they have a UN program on statelessness, and they were looking for speakers. So I thought to myself, well, heck, I can do that.
Yeah, but they want to give people passports who don't have a state. That's their idea.
Exactly. That's what I discovered is that. Because I thought, cool, I'll show them why statelessness is a great thing to be. And of course, the UN poo-poos the notion.
They don't
of
like statelessness. They'll get you a state. You know, like if your country dissolves or you're kicked out of your country and you didn't do anything that offends the UN, they will go out of their way to find you a state and ply it on you,
where you can be a tax cattle in said tax jurisdiction, because that's all states are.
It's even
places where ranchers and zookeepers keep their tax cattle.
Yeah, and it's even beyond that, because a lot of the people that, you know, they find states for are people who will probably never produce a lot of taxes. Their head explodes at the thought of a stateless person. They don't like it. It sets a bad example for the actual tax cattle.
It certainly isn't, because if somebody did that, then that would mean that they wouldn't be available for the shearing, and every bureaucrat objects to that.
Yeah,
the UN. So to me, a failed state, the bottom line from my thinking, and I suppose from your thinking, is that a failed state is a happy state for the individuals who live there.
Maybe. depends. Yeah. Because failed state, the vacuum, the so-called vacuum of a lack of state is often filled by state-like entities, everything from warlords to roving bands of idiots to, you know, JSOC.
Well, that's just because they don't have badges on. That's why they object to them. If they had badges on, they wouldn't be so concerned about it.
So the UN should just print up badges for everybody when a state fails. Deputize everyone.
They should.
Or they should just do it themselves. It's been a great show, Bill.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on.
Thanks for being had.
See you, Michael.
It's great having you on. You can find out more about Bill Buebert by going to zerogov.com. You can check out his book. What's the name of your unicorn book?
It is Limited Government, Unicorns, and Other Mythological Creatures, with a big zero gov at the beginning.
Excellent. Excellent. And we'll be back tomorrow.
Thanks, Michael. Always an honor.
Thank you, man. It's definitely an honor. Worms.
Bye.